So we will do a round of Q&A. Of course, the cases that we have been hearing from you lead us to this decentering of art histories. We have not here almost New York and neither Paris. Where is Catherine Dozan? Yeah. And the stories also have been somehow intertwined between different regions, like Tricontinental also poses into a third position. And there I would like to ask your comments on using another quote by Fidel Castro that I'm sure you know. So it was very impressive when I found this testimony where he said, capitalists and imperialists are our enemies, not abstract art. Oh. And when we confront the collections of these various museums of solidarity that emerged very inspired in the Museo de Solidaridad from Chile, you see this eclecticism. And at the first view, you are confused because you have the reference of formalistic art histories and to the West-East divide. And the other divide, North-South, also is not working because they have collections across regions. So Christine was mentioned David Craven, that also had been fundamental. Anselm and I have been following how he has traced the political history of minimal art and abstract art in Latin America. So even the most abstract brushstroke can also be political. So it has a reference to the context. And then we come back to this Marxist critique of Meyer Shapiro, that even the most abstract work has been done in a context, in certain conditions of possibility. An abstract work would not be possible, he said very pedagogically, for example, in the Middle Ages as expression of the individual freedom. So certain conditions that allow even this like a slogan of individuality, autonomy that Catherine Dozan was framing in a brilliant way. So I would like to hear your comments on how you also traverse this eclecticism and position it in the politic and aesthetic debates through your research to start the conversation, to warm up, and then I will see the hands that will join us.
Well, thank you, Pat. So, yes, I mean, the words of Castro I knew, and so I mean Cuba had this was a place for a moment, but for a longer moment that we have a knowledge, because I think David Craven is one of the few North American scholars that was given this approach, and there is the other book is Art and Revolution in Latin America, in which he addresses Mexico, Cuba, and then Nicaragua, and so especially was this idea of going against, well, the idea was of creating an internationalist movement and bringing artists, no matter what kind of language that they were using. And so they were, you know, Fidel Castro, the words to the intellectuals, 45 pages, is like long, the guy was talking and talking, but actually the idea was the ambiguity, and so it left some room in different moments of the story to bring artists of all kind of languages. And so developing this kind of work, and the idea was to work collectively and to work without working in a place that was not anymore a bourgeois society, so not having to expose in a gallery, not producing within a museum, sharing spaces with weapons. So for the artists, I mean, I have studied mostly the relation of international artists with Cuba, and for this conference, I changed the focus. It was fascinating because it was the possibility to not taking care of this kind of rigid structures of production. But the thing is, then in historiography, they usually when I show these images, they tell me, "Oh, it's super ugly." You know what they did? it's not experimental enough. So I mean, and this is why for a long time these kind of stories, they are not interesting because they don't have the aesthetical value that we give in the West to these stories. But I mean, what is interesting is what the clashes that they produce, you know, and the relations that, because this is something that is interesting when we study the canonical and even not just the canonical, but also the book Art Scenes, which was a rethinking of the Western art history. Still, you cannot fit these stories because we are still working on this kind of progressive and also, even if it's more fragmentary, but this kind of encounters in which you have experimental artists with figurative artists, with communists, with all kind of ideologies and languages working together, they cannot fit anymore. And so what I think also regarding the situation with Cuba, that I was a little bit concerned, because the situation could be, could be open to experimentation in a specific moment. It closed also for a period, and then it opened again. But I mean, for a long time, when you see art history, not David Craven, but a Latin American art history book, usually Cuba is out of the story because it doesn't fit at all, you know? And so this is why I think we have to bring these kind of stories, and I will pass to someone else that wants to say something. I know I don't have to pass, okay.
Yeah, maybe just to follow up on sort of the question of work that is not aesthetically sort of interesting. I think that's what, and I'm not saying that that's what these collections are, but in fact what these collections allow for, and I'll maybe focus on three less on the Art Against Apartheid collection. It was much smaller and felt very focused, and many of them were very famous artists whose works were very well known, so maybe that's a very different case. But I think that's what kind of in terms, in imagining building a collection today, or how museums or collectors build collections, and what the sort of where the intentions lay. In the case of, in many of the cases of these, you know, these three museums, for example, in most cases, artists were donating the work. So it actually wasn't really, it was sometimes up to maybe a person who was involved, but it was most often up to the artist to donate the work that they chose and thought was most appropriate. And there were certainly discussions around that. You know, even in the exhibition in Beirut, there was a roundtable around sort of what kinds of works were appropriate for the revolution. Of course, this was, you know, these were debates that were happening at that time. And in fact, there was a survey that took place. I'm kind of going on a tangent, but there was a survey for an artist, Nasser Sumi, had done after the opening of the International Art Exhibition for Palestine, where he asked people what their favorite works were and which were their least favorite and what kind of work they would want more of. And so, you know, the range, it was, I don't know if it was surprising, but there were a few works that were sort of, you know, found very interesting. The Miró, for example, was not on the top of that list. Miró work was not on the top of that list, but works that sort of felt like they very clearly supported the revolution or the struggle for Palestine were at the top in the case of this exhibition. And when they had asked people what kinds of works they would want to see, they said, we actually want to see confiscated weapons, right? Israeli weapons. They actually wanted to see more of the work that maybe one would see in Cuba, like to see sort of the weapons within that, or that kind of imagery, whether it's through the objects themselves or in the artwork, is what some people were interested in. At the same time, there was an exhibition. One of the artists took about 20 works to a camp in Beirut, a Palestinian camp in Beirut, and also did a survey there. And the works that were found to be the most interesting were the abstract works. So, I mean, how can one read into that? You know, one could assume, you know, very, you know, naively that, you know, people would connect more to the figurative works. But I think these are the moments of where assumption should not be there, that, you know, you have to challenge this. I think I went on a tangent. I don't know if I addressed your question.
And for André, I was following the story of how you founded the Mayibu Center in the 90s, and you took the slogan of the struggle against apartheid, "Let it return." So Mayibuyi means "let it return." So I would like that you share with us how was your method of convoking all these archives. You show us this photo with many of the former prisoners arriving with the boxes, with the banana box that became like a model, guerrilla model. So this unites with the other panel for archiving. So did this "let it return" was like an official call or was a rumor? How was this socialization of your "let it return"?
Yeah, I think Suraj has helped me as well. What's interesting about the connections with the Cuban work and Nicaragua is that it's late 70s. Cuba is much earlier, but that's part of a kind of specific anti-imperialist solidarity network. In South Africa, you also had the Black Consciousness, which was an artistic renaissance. It was art, poetry, performance, internally generated. So I think we had maybe two phases, an internal one that was like an African aesthetic that was being developed. Black man, you're on your own kind of Black Consciousness of Biko. It had a very strong cultural dimension. And then as the ANC, the Congress tradition, becomes stronger after Biko's death from the late 70s to 83, there's a more clear tie-up to these other networks, I think. They've been there all the time, but there's a culture and resistance conference in Botswana in 82. There's culture in another South Africa in 85 in Amsterdam. So there's like a very big mobilization internationally there. And that's where Maibuya comes from also, because it's linked to a specific political tradition that was very strong by the 1980s. And it's the second half from 85 onwards. So it's almost preparing to govern. And Maibuya Afrikaans mean always let Africa return. So it's part of a nationalist struggle with a universal kind of dimension to it, I think. But that probably locates the name, and that was both the strength and the weakness in some respects, if you look critically at the Maibuya experiment, that it was seen as very linked to the political struggle. So it was, as we explained, like, you know, sort of seeing ourselves as public intellectuals and working across spaces, trying to introduce a critical dimension, but at the same time, I think from 1990 with the unbannings to 94, it was a very strong kind of lead that was taken by the Congress movement. And within that, those 4 years, you are looking at preparing to govern rather than critically examining the struggle kind of art and and linkages. But what we did in April 27 is our day that democracy came to South Africa, and we had these amazing queues as people voted patiently for the first time ever. But in May, we at Maibuya released correspondence from the archives where Mandela and one of his famous comrades had disagreed very strongly with each other, to the point of not speaking to each other. It was based on ideological divisions in what was called the high organ. And it was in the Sunday newspapers, big news, and they were very unhappy with me because I'd sort of said, it's time now with freedom to start looking critically at the contradictions that exist in every struggle and so on. So that's a little bit of the background from our side, I think, on the development of art within the struggle and how it becomes prominent, and that name.
Anybody would like to pose a question from the audience? There's a couple of questions.
Andre, I think what could be also interesting in just in relation to the idea of art as political solidarity and art as weapon of struggle. What changes in 1991, especially now, just thinking of your work with LB Sachs and bringing all of these different components of a highly complex figure like LB Sachs together, is LB in 1991 writes Preparing Ourselves for Freedom. And I mean, that is a moment in which the idea that we held on so truly to in the 1980s of the purpose of the artist is to be a resource of resistance, that the artwork has to be political in a very instrumentalist sense. That of course Albi then says the time is ripe to move away from that. And the reason why I think this question is important is if we think of the transition from struggle to preparing to govern to governing, and how instrumental the culture sector has become to the state and to the ruling party, and how actually we were almost at the stage of museums being kind of caught in a grip of a state that is at war with itself, and where museums are demanded to be described as agencies of the government. And that is how come you have private collections that suddenly, or even commercial galleries, that end up doing the cultural work that needs to be done somewhere else.
I think he mentions two things in that. The one is the sort of change from situations of underground activity where survival is at stake and the poster is powerful and you can't have dual kind of, you can't be thinking relatively when it's a matter of life or death. And that's where you have that very strong 1980s political posters in South Africa, incredibly strong. And then Albi Sachs is an amazing person because he was almost the main drafter of the Constitution of South Africa. And at the heart of the insurrection in 1986, and at the heart of the kind of anti-imperialist armed seizure of power moment, they actually set up in Lusaka a constitution committee with a mandate to say every struggle ends in sitting around a table, and we are going to have a multi-party democracy with a Bill of Rights to protect every person, every citizen. The only thing that we will not accept is group rights, because that will be a neo-colonial version of apartheid, and all the ruling class elements wanted federalism, consociationalism, or some kind of group rights. And Albi was blown up in a car bomb. He lost his eye and his arm while he was writing the draft constitutional principles. And then he was lying in hospital. He's written a beautiful book on how he survived this. And one of his comrades came and said, "Don't worry, we will avenge your thing." And he said, "No more vengeance." So that's why it's called the soft vengeance. And I'm sure, now that you mention it, it's linked to that already, the decision that was taken. They were writing a Bill of Rights there. No more shooting, no more revenge. Let us now use culture to celebrate the diversity of South African sort of cultural legacy and heritage. The other point is that museums, what I didn't do was problematize what we did. From the beginning, colleagues at UWC were also challenging this Rainbow Nation idea. And today it's very discredited, and Mandela's legacy is also being challenged. There's also recently been a wonderful book that says you actually must not look at that we're Rainbow Nation in a superficial sense. It comes from a very deep African kind of source of including and opening up. And the struggle against apartheid was always universal. And the argument, Siraj, and I think it's worth as a question exploring, is that Mandela represented an African radical kind of African humanism that went beyond modernity, beyond winning the struggle and the vengeance that came with winning the struggle, to looking for something deeper, to create a new society of a different kind. So we were a miracle of sorts in 1994 to reach a negotiated settlement of an issue like Palestine and like, you know, Eastern Europe, some of the problems there. But museums lost their critical, the brief moment to be critical was lost by the political intervention of the liberation elite. And in our case, in 2002, I resigned because I was basically told that the ex-prisoners, a few of them ran the boats to the island for their private gain, and that I need to change the contract halfway through a 7-year period so that they could get less money, which meant that the museum will get less money, and we were already subsidizing 20% of our visitors were school children because of the educational component. It was not a very difficult thing for me to say no, and then they said, we must take over the island, the ex-prisoners must take over the island. So we had a ridiculous situation in 2002 that a general in the South African army was staging a hunger strike, a pseudo hunger strike in the prison, so that the prisoner's legacy would be retaken back in a state institution of the democracy. So you have this, and he was a director in the ship, in the boat company that was running the private sector thing. So you have the conflation of political connection and economic self-interest, which is what caused state capture later. So the Zuma years is the state is everything. The constitutional, this incredible constitution which separates different, you know, state, the judiciary and others, is then just compromised by the party deciding what should happen outside. And then it happens in the institution, and the institution gets turned upside down. And Robben Island, in that moment of rupture, lost its entire intellectual critical project. It now becomes a thing where the directors and the managers must tick off their budgets and state from the state. There's no, the intellectual capital that was used to develop this vision was outsourced. And we lost all the staff in this institution whose job it was to create that kind of intellectual vision from inside. And really, it became hollowed out intellectually and lost a lot of that momentum. So it became a kind of a tourist thing where heads of state came and they were deferentially treated and nothing much happened on the cultural front. Sorry, I took a long time for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for all of the three of you. Very interesting talks. What I find also interesting, and this becomes visible within your talks and also within the exhibition and all the time here in the house and all the time you see interesting exhibitions, it's the importance, and what you also mentioned, I think, the importance of archives. And the importance of archives, so archives of documental written material. What I find, and this is just like regarding also this idea of historical canons and also alternative narratives, counter narratives, I think very much that art history is very often too much object based. This is art historians themselves in academia, but also the institutions of museums. So if you, museums are also archives, but they host these kind of objects, and the oldest museums have actually the, let's say, the value, the symbolic value they have developed over, let's say, sometimes more than a century. And of course, this symbolic value also eventually translates into money. If you look what the Louvre is selling, merchandising, or the Metropolitan, or the Rijksmuseum, so it's money, it's capital in the end. So I think in based on this idea, on this understanding, and they don't want to give up this kind of capital. And based on this idea, I think a way to go is actually not just like to look at the objects, but to really value much more the archival material, to develop actually also narratives on artworks that are in these predominant objectal archives, museums, and then develop new narratives. And if more people do this, I think, and also just like emphasize on the importance to go to the original sources, because in art history, what we do very often is just like, yeah, we take maybe one new source, we add a new piece, but it still fits into the old narrative, so we don't change it. It's going back to the source, actually. What I would like you, maybe to those of you sitting there on the stage right now, maybe share your ideas about the importance of archives, because I think within your research it became visible regarding also recreating something that is not there anymore. It was just like the object was missing, or the objects were missing. Also research.
We have a last minute. Thank you for the question. And I would like to pick up the second question so we don't miss her, because she was waiting also. And we do a last round.
Thank you. I'll try to be fast. Thank you, all of you. I was wondering in regard to your presentation, Paula. You mentioned these encounters in May and after that, the three examples you mentioned. Yes, were conceived and organized in the spirit of the Tricontinental that was supposed to link, as the name expresses, the three continents. Do these exhibitions and encounters of artists included artists from Africa and Asia, like the Tricontinental was supposed to like foster? And And then, what do you think that was the role or the space, if it had one, of race in the counter narratives of or the art program of the Tricontinental?
Okay, so we have these two last questions. I think we could specify the question of archives to André, because he had been crucial in founding the center that hosts this legacy of activism. And we don't know so much how you dealt with all this amount of archival material. And also to specify to Christine, because when Christine and Russia are interviewing the protagonist that were part of collectives, they somehow gather different testimonies. They practice what is they term the oral history. And this oral history has certain limits, like which testimony is stronger, how much mystification, how much self-heroization, and how precise the speakers, the protagonists, remember events of 30 years ago. So I would like to take your question and specify to them. And Paula received already a few points.
So thank you very much. So I mean, good questions. Regarding the participation of artists that were not coming from that they were coming from Asia of Africa. So it depends on the edition on the exhibition, because of the exhibition of the Salon de May was mainly a Parisian-based institution. So there were artists coming from France, but they were not French. I mean, there were a lot of artists from all kind of origins. A main person that was we could discuss is, for example, Wilfredo Lang, who was an Afro-Cuban artist and who was introducing Afro-Cuban also Actually, he iconography, but also rituals, and also, you must know very well, thinking already the way of painting was an act of decolonization. So, well, in this case, I don't think there were much artists coming outside of this from Africa, but actually the case of Wilfredo Lam. On the other cases, as for example, the Cultural Congress was full of all kind of people. I couldn't check everyone, but people from Asia and Africa arrived. A specific artist, I cannot, I think, answer that at this moment, but I could check. Regarding and the others that I showed, there were Latin American encounters. But the question of Afro-Latin America was a big question, and especially the question of race was what sustained the project of the Tricontinental. And if you, it's a pity that I haven't shown you that, but the Tricontinental was based in the vision of race as something that was bigger from nation, that was actually that connected all the struggles, was fundamental. And in the posters, we can see it very well as they presented, for example, there is one very interesting poster where you have three fighters from Africa, from Asia, and from Latin America, and they are cut into pieces and they are interchangeable. So, I mean, in the Tricontinental project, this was a fundamental element. For the artistic activities or exhibitions that happened around, finally, Cuba was, as far as I know, but my research is actually from an international perspective that comes also with the connection with Europe. It was pretty much also looking to Europe-based artists from different parts of the world, or also Latino American artists. But for sure, there will be much more to see because, and I would just do the last point, because the archives in Cuba, there are not much work done on them, and are disintegrating, literally disintegrating in the really, it is very difficult to conserve all the paper with the climate, and also the lack of funding. So, I mean, probably they were, you know, an exhibition. So, for example, at the Cultural Congress, they did a Yoruba theater play and things like that. So, a lot to do, I would say. Thank you.
Maybe in response to the question of oral history, I think Russia mentioned this, that fact-checking is very difficult to do. And I think in all cases, right, I think different people tell the stories of their memories of these events in different ways. And one has to remember that memory is emotional, that you also have to forget to remember. So I'll say in the case of Nicaragua, you know, we are speaking to people who are not exactly in favor of the current government. So this was very complicated to even speak to them today about something that had happened 30 years prior, or over 30, you know, 35 years, 40 years before. So even just the act of speaking to someone in the moment, knowing that what they could say could have implications on kind of their safety. So even just the, you know, that has affected even the narrative that I'm able to share, right? So there's maybe more material, there are other stories, but the space of sharing that is also a sort of protection or censorship in a way, or I would say protection out of respect for the people that we've met. So, and in fact, kind of that moment of December, of meeting them in December 2017, and just, you know, a few months later, you know, there being a very violent sort of violent episodes throughout the country, realizing that, you know, there could be stakes. Granted, I'm sure no one is looking towards, you know, art museums or art spaces for narratives around kind of these histories, but these are things that one has to take into account. So certainly, I mean, I think the, you know, the even the people that we're speaking to are from a generation who are old, who are passing away. You know, there are people that we've met that have passed away, and when many of these histories remain with them. This is the same question of archives that are disintegrating in Cuba when, you know, these stories are held with people. These are just as important as sort of the access to these documents, which also need to be questioned in and of themselves in terms of veracity. So it's the document itself is not necessarily the truth either. So I would kind of keep that question. Absolutely. Completely. Absolutely. Absolutely. And just because you have access to the archive doesn't mean that is the narrative, but that is in fact a space to start to tell one version of that history.
Yeah, I think what you've just said now, generational, intergenerational memories are very important. So revisiting the archive brings different interpretations always. For South Africa, there was a very literate generations of black writers and politicians up to the bannings of Sharpeville. So people wrote about the Atlantic Charter, and there was debate about it, and socialism versus nationalism, and so on. But after the bannings, within 2 years, or maybe even one, 302 or 304 writers were banned. And you couldn't quote their work, you couldn't distribute their writings, you couldn't read it in a library. So when I studied at Stellenbosch University, if there was a banned work that you wanted to consult, you had to fill in a form, and it was in a locked cupboard, and you had to sit there, and they'd show you the book for study purposes. But that was like not, you know, it was really locked down, a whole body of writers and intellectuals and debates, political debate was just stopped, and it was driven underground. And so what you heard is like the political positions of revolutionary organizations rather than the correspondence between people, the debates that were happening internally in public. There was no public debate. I was 34 years old when I first saw, I was in my late 20s when I first saw a photograph of Mandela when I went to England, because it was banned from distributing his image there. And so that level, it was a censored society in every respect. So the archive becomes so precious for those 30 years. So getting these personal kind of letters are very important. But what I wanted to say is the problem with archives as well. While the Mayabuye Center was collecting, it was like a very dynamic activity in which there was energy and filmmaking happening and people using archives in a very active way. But it's become an embedded archive. Because we started Mayabuye Center on sort of money that we had to generate on our own, the long-term security for it was to make it part of Robben Island Museum as the archives collection. And now it's the archives collection of a museum, and it's just sitting there unused in the dynamic way that it was earlier. But I think having the archive is crucial because people will come to it in due course and discover new things in it.
Thank you, everybody, for being with us this afternoon and for just very short closing remarks to tie it all together in a few points. I think it's fascinating to follow how all the speakers today, although the cases are so important, they are not usual in the art history debate. They go beyond the case, and they are interrogating how to historize, how to memorialize, and how to exhibit solidarity movement and other legacies of activism, especially in the field of art historiography, as Catherine Dozan started, what narratives are available not only to deconstruct and problematize, but also to rearticulate power structures. And therefore, for us, have been very fundamental in the making or envisioning of alternative narratives, the geopolitical model that she is developing beyond the single work and the single artist into the larger context across nations and regions. And in the practice of exhibitions, because we're in Haus der Kultur und der Welt, now we have three parallel exhibitions, how not only to apply or to use categories, but as Anselm Franke was developing, how certain histories of categories can become in crisis into the exhibition space, so we could also answer you how the positivism, truth, or fictionalization start getting ambivalent, and perhaps realism and imaginary start to accompany each other in a more ambiguous and plural way. The same as figuration and abstraction through conceptualism also became a narrative to tell and a portrait of the very moment of this rereading, of this exhibiting, of this narrating. So thank you, and let's make an applause for all the great speakers today.